Welcome to The Dig. My name is Daniel Denver, and I'm broadcasting from AS220 in Providence, Rhode Island. Trump's election has a lot of people upset and ready to organize. Longtime activists for economic and racial justice are confronted with the welcome challenge of freshly angry hordes pouring into meetings and protests, looking to take action. It's the silver lining to what is otherwise a nightmare, but it's all that we've got, and given the circumstances, we have to embrace it. Today's episode was recorded at a live event I did recently with journalist Sarah Jaffe, who is on tour talking about her new book, Necessary Trouble, Americans in Revolt. The book is about recent social movements, movements we must expand and deepen to defeat the far right and to finally start winning.
I'm very happy to have my friend and colleague Sarah Jaffe here, who has a very exciting and unfortunately more pertinent than ever could have been imagined new book out called Necessary Trouble, Americans in Revolt. Sarah is a Nation Institute fellow and an independent journalist covering labor, economic justice, social movements, politics, gender, and pop culture. Her work has appeared in The Nation, The Week, The American Prospect, The Washington Post, The Atlantic, and many other publications. She is the co-host with Michelle Chen of Dissent Magazine's Belabored podcast. And Necessary Trouble is her first book. Sarah's going to start off reading a passage from the book.
So, yeah, I've been thinking about the miscellaneous parts of this book that are more relevant than ever. And I wanted to read something from my last chapter about Occupy Sandy, because I think that one of the things that's going to be more relevant than ever is localized movements to take care of each other. So, winter was coming in New York when we got the news about Hurricane Sandy. The storm, as it moved north, had been caught up in an unusual weather pattern. In the words of one Weather Channel hurricane expert, it was becoming a monstrous hybrid vortex, a combination of a hurricane and a nor'easter. Somewhere along the line, it was dubbed Superstorm Sandy. We didn't know how bad it would be, just that we'd never seen anything like it. It was the end of October 2012, just after the first anniversary of Occupy Wall Street, and later than usual for hurricanes. But climate scientists had warned that warmer waters and a higher sea level had put New York City and its environs at risk of record storm surges. I stocked up on non-perishable goods. A friend of mine who lived out in Coney Island came to stay with me at my Crown Heights apartment, well away from the flood zone. That night, we sat and watched TV and checked Twitter for updates. That was where we saw the video of the water rushing into the subways. That was also where I saw the first hints of something else happening. People I followed from the Occupy days were starting to talk to each other about what they could do to help. They had come together in response to the financial crisis. Now they were preparing to deal with a very different crisis. Julieta Salgado, an organizer with the Occupy-related Free University, said it began with a group text. Let's get on our bikes and go see what we can do. Someone suggested heading to the Red Hook Initiative, a community center in the waterfront Brooklyn neighborhood of Red Hook. Salgado and Emma Francis walked from their Bedford-Stuyvesant home and decided to knock on doors and collect donations. In Carroll Gardens, a wealthy neighborhood nearby but outside of the flood zone, the group went door to door asking for anything people could give, blankets, candles, food. No one turned us down, Salgado said. The next day, when she returned to the Red Hook Initiative, she saw people who had given her supplies the night before who had come to help. People in the gentrified parts of Brooklyn were happy to donate, but nonetheless, Salgado said, it was already obvious that the storm had not hit everyone equally. Red Hook was a long walk from the nearest subway, and although it had become desirable real estate for reasonably well-off artsy types, it was also still the site of high-rise public housing. Without power and with stores in their neighborhoods closed, it was the people who were already poor who were left struggling down up flights of stairs in search of help. A few days later, I joined up with two friends and walked from Crown Heights to Red Hook. I had already heard reports that the Red Cross was conspicuously absent in the storm-ravaged areas, and that community groups and Occupy activists had stepped in to fill the vacant space. The hashtag Occupy Sandy had spread across Twitter. The old networks were moving. At the Red Hook Initiative, we found a well-oiled volunteer machine distributing food, diapers, clothing, blankets, and other needed items to lines of people. It was days after the hurricane had hit, and people told us they still had no power. Familiar faces from Occupy eventually directed us to another Occupy Sandy hub further south because there were so many volunteers in Red Hook that they didn't know what to do with us. In Sunset Park at St. Jacoby Church, the division of labor that had created the kitchen and comfort and medic stations in Zuccotti Park was at work once again as occupiers cooked hot meals and packed donations into bags to be loaded into cars headed for Coney Island or the Rockaway Peninsula. "It's amazing how organized we are," said Michael Primo, one of the Occupy organizers in Sunset Park. Added Salgado, "The joke is on Mayor Bloomberg. The people you spent $60 million trying to destroy were the first people on the ground." The next day, I joined organizer Deshaun Burris from New York Communities for Change as he canvassed in the Rockaways to see what people needed. "You from FEMA?" people asked us over and over again, referring, of course, to the Federal Emergency Management Agency, which had yet to be spotted. We saw one Red Cross truck, but quite a few police cars. "All I see is cops, and they're still harassing us," said Kenyatta Hutchinson, who stood by the floodline on his neighbor's house above his head. "The police didn't respond to requests for help," he said, but he was afraid to take his things out of his own house, worried he'd be accused of looting. The people in this working class, mostly black neighborhood were used to being left behind and over-policed, but after the storm had wiped out their homes, the presence of security before aid was heaping insult on very real injury. "This whole system is built around punishment and prevention of abuse instead of providing service," said Judy Sheridan Gonzalez, an emergency room nurse and at the time vice president of the New York State Nurses Association. After spending a few days volunteering in the Rockaways, she had quickly realized that Occupy Sandy was the organization that was willing to do whatever was needed. She had tried to work with the Red Cross, with FEMA, or the New York Department of Health, but there was so much bureaucracy that nothing was getting done. "There was no public health infrastructure preparation at all," she said. I will stop there.
Thank you so much. That was really moving. And that was a that was an incredible moment. I stopped through St. Jacoby Church for a few days and seeing the mobilization from Zuccotti Park, where we spent a morning together once.
Which is also in my book.
In action again was was something. So I want to start not at the book's beginning or ending, but after the ending, right now. When you set out to write this, I take it you had no idea that Donald Trump would be elected president.
No.
Soon after you published.
No, I did not.
You tell these amazing, complicated stories about all these social movements, Walmart workers, Black Lives Matter, Moral Mondays, the Chicago Teachers Union, Occupy Wall Street, Fight for 15, that flourished under Obama. They were all often fighting Obama, but nonetheless, Obama was the context. Now, Trump, what did you learn in your reporting that might provide a roadmap for the people getting prepared for a long, nasty, high-stakes fight right now?
I mean, part of that is the reason that I wanted to read the Occupy Sandy section, right? Is that, like, on the one hand, we saw movements really learning how to take care of each other. And that's true not just of Occupy Sandy, but of really of the Black Lives Matter networks in many places. And so that's a thing that I think is going to have to be really, really important right now is if, you know, Paul Ryan gets his way and social services are cut back at the same time as police are newly empowered, it's going to be much more security before aid, right? And that's a thing that we have to think about constantly. On the flip side, one of the things also is that, like, a lot of people who voted for someone like Donald Trump are also mad about some of the same things we're mad about. And they are taking a totally wrong solution. And one of our goals has to be to point out the ways in which that is, this is not a solution for them, and it's actually hurting other people. And I've been thinking a lot about a story that I actually did this summer before the book came out, that just actually came out a couple weeks ago. And I went to Indiana and I was talking to some folks who run an organization called just the Workers Project. And they have been organizing unemployed people. They have been organizing alongside the local unions and organizing undocumented workers. And they told me the story of this campaign that they had run. And if you'll forgive my vulgar language, they were talking about how they had really fought for this campaign to not be titled, you know, local jobs for local people. They really said, you know, our operating plan has to be, if they're getting fucked, we're getting fucked. And that's really,
that you use this language, Sarah.
I am so shocked. No, but this was, you know, when they, you know, this is the building trades. So, like, you know, this is a thing. But, like, but also it was a very blunt way of saying that, like, actually we don't win the organized building trades guys in Indiana didn't win by screwing over undocumented immigrant workers. or by throwing those guys out of jobs, but actually the same companies are ripping off the unionized workers, are ripping off the undocumented workers even more, and that they actually needed to stand together. And so, you know, I think that that's going to be a really important point to prove that has clearly not been proven nearly enough. If we're actually looking at people in Rust Belt cities that thought that Donald Trump was a solution. And yeah, the last thing that I think is just going to be really, really, really important is that we are going to have to think about and strategize around civil disobedience, around really massive sort of disruptive protest in a way that a lot of people have not been comfortable doing yet. And, you know, my book is about how many, many thousands of people have gotten much more comfortable with that than they were, you know, 8 years ago. But that said, it's just going to have to ratchet up, you know, much more than that, because there's this, you know, Jeff Sessions as Attorney General is a horror show waiting to happen.
Yeah, it's utterly unacceptable. And we've already seen massive protests over the last few weeks. There'll probably be hundreds of thousands of people in D.C. for the inauguration. And I think a lot of people are wondering, though, what the connection is between these discrete protest actions and organized movement building. And then also the connections between, or the balance or whatever, between playing defense, whether it's against Trump's deportation raids or whatever, or cuts to the ACA, and also trying to keep our eye on the...
Keep your eyes on the prize?
Yeah, the world, building the world we want.
Yeah, I think that that's going to be really hard to do. And this was the, you know, this was the point that I saw a lot of leftists making in articulating an argument for why the left should vote for Hillary Clinton, even if they found her a disappointing candidate, was that, like, we actually have to be able to, you know, fight for the positive things that we want. We have to, you know, again, the fights are still sort of all the same fights, right? But it's easier, you know, in some level when you're looking at a fairly, you know, a sort of center liberal administration to say we need more than this. And it can be easy, like it was under George W. Bush, to think that, like, anything is better than this. If we have a really right-wing administration, and in particular, we have this, you know, incoming president who has just ridden into the White House on a rave of racist tirades, it's going to be so important, because there's this article, I don't know if everybody saw this, it went around pretty viral on my Facebook feed anyway, this article about a town in a neighborhood in Milwaukee, and they went to a barbershop, and they're talking to, you know, working class black guys in Milwaukee who are saying that they didn't vote for Hillary Clinton, because one of them in particular didn't vote for Hillary Clinton because her husband's policies had been responsible for him spending 20 years in prison. And, you know, the rest of them, several of them didn't really feel anything. And I like the write-ins where there were two guys who wrote in a presidential candidate, and one wrote in Bernie Sanders and the other one wrote in himself, which I think is, that combination makes me smile. But, like, we also, you know, we need to give those people a positive reason to come out, because this kind of, you know, like these arguments that a lot of people on the left were making before this election, that, like, well, you need to vote for Hillary Clinton even if she doesn't, you know, blah, 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 whatever, is that, like, people who are disconnected from movements, which is most of America still, nobody's making that kind of strategic voting argument, right? Because you're not involved in building a movement. You're just trying to get through the day. And that positive vision, whether we like it or not, Donald Trump motivated more people who had previously not voted, and he was giving them a vision of something. And the vision, I think, is horrifying, but to combat that, we can't just say, you know, vote for Donald Trump or vote for, you know, whichever Democrat runs in 2020 because Donald Trump is a horror show. Like, they tried that. That was a strategy of the Clinton campaign, and it totally failed.
Yeah, I mean, it spectacularly failed. Their strategy very explicitly was, for every white working class voter that we lose, we're going to pick up two moderate Republican suburban women who are offended by Trump.
Yeah, and it personally didn't happen. It just didn't happen.
And so your book discusses both Occupy and the Tea Party as very different revolts against a bipartisan neoliberal status quo that bailed out the banks but sat back as regular people lost their homes and jobs. And Trump is also a revolt, however reactionary, and also a sign of the collapse of the of this neoliberal establishment under the weight of stagnant wages and just despair about the future. Did Trump and right-wing white identity politics have to be the result? And does Trumpism, does it have to carry the day in the years to come now that it has won?
No, and I don't think it will. So I was driving today. I live in Newburgh, New York, so I basically live like straight across 84, driving across Connecticut. And I saw a guy with a Trump sticker on the bumper of his car, and it was already like scraped off partly. And I'm really hoping that that was a sign of like a wave of buyer's remorse among Trump voters. But like, so Donald Trump is going to enter office, which is a horrifying sentence I realize that I just said. But like, he's going to enter office as the least popular president in American history. He's going to enter office with negatives that are higher than I think than Obama's negatives have ever been. He is going to enter office having been the recipient already of hundreds of thousands of people protesting around this country. He has already been the target of high school students walking out in not just in places like Berkeley, but in places like Omaha. These are already moving, right? And that's the like high school students organizing walkouts. It's not easy. I remember when I was a high school student, we didn't do much of anything that was serious. Like, so the fact that, you know, they're organized walkouts in response to a presidential election all over the country is pretty amazing. We were talking about this before, actually, we started here about how we have to sort of both take Trump very, very seriously, because Trump and Mike Pence and Paul Ryan are going to govern as if they won 75% of the vote. And that both is, you know, terrifying and we have to fight it. And also they're going to massively overstep. Because the people who voted for Trump did not vote to dismantle Medicare. They didn't. The people in the Tea Party did not want to dismantle Medicare. There were, you know, polls and studies over and over again that show that these people do not want to actually, they do not want the policies that the Paul Ryans of the world want. In fact, most of them don't even want the policies that the Mike Pences of the world want. And that's really important going forward is, again, like, these people are a massive threat, but actually, like, they're not the majority. You know, we were saying there's like three things about this election. One is that Hillary Clinton did, in fact, actually win, right? She is going to have something like almost 2 million more votes than Donald Trump. Second is that her strategy was flawed, right? Which is that, again, this idea that targeting conservatives, that trying to separate Trump from the rest of the Republican Party and saying that, like, no, he's different and uniquely threatening, both A, was exactly what his primary voters liked about him, and B, was not true, because look at who's going to be in his administration. Like, on the one hand, it's going to be neo-fascists like Steve Bannon, and on the other hand, it's going to be people who are elected Republican officials, from New York to Alabama. Thank you, Rudy Giuliani. I'm not letting my city or my former city off the hook there. Or, you know, Mitt Romney, since I'm from Massachusetts. And so, thinking about that, and then the last point was that, like, the name Clinton in the Rust Belt means NAFTA, and, you know, so part of that is bad strategy, which is they didn't try to go into those, into, you know, Rust Belt cities and campaign and say no, we're going to do something other than NAFTA. And the other part is just that, like, unfortunately, for which is, you know, somewhat unfair to Hillary Clinton, I should say, right, that, you know, she's not ultimately responsible for everything that her husband did. But when people look back at the 90s now, they see the path laid for where we ended up, and they don't like it. And that really was just, you know, it's somewhat unfair to Hillary Clinton that she is married to Bill, and that people do not anymore look back on Bill Clinton's presidency as a time of positive things for this country. But it's what happened. And, you know, if we're thinking, we don't really have political parties in this country the same way they have them in other countries, but like, if we actually had an organized Democratic Party that we could actually consider appointing a leader to, it should not be somebody who is seen as, you know, a relic of these policies that people have rejected.
Yeah, and who was an outspoken defender by her husband's side at the time.
Yeah, many of those things, right? And if she had changed her mind about these things, really failed to articulate how that, you know, what that would mean going forward for her administration.
Which brings me to a popular counterfactual historical discussion that has occupied a lot of people on the left recently, which is nonetheless, I think, an important one in terms of looking at what the left's electoral strategy is looking for with regard to engagement with electoral politics. And there's been a lot of speculation. We can't know for sure, but one can make an argument that Bernie would have won. What do you think about that?
I can at least make an argument that he would have gone to Wisconsin more than once.
Yeah. what do you think of that, and how do you think the left should think about electoral politics moving forward? In your book, you talk about Bernie. You also talk about socialist alternatives experience in Seattle, where they won a city council seat by mobilizing around the Fight for 15.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that really, we tend to obsess about presidential politics, and that takes up all of the air in the room. And like, as a journalist who was trying to work, and I mean, I was writing a book, so I was somewhat disconnected from like the daily grind of beat reporting. But as somebody who was not covering the presidential race at all, I wrote one piece 2 years ago about how we should not talk about Hillary Clinton as inevitable, which also is a piece that I wish I had been wrong about. but right now, point being that it was almost impossible to get any attention to any story I wanted to do unless I could somehow connect it to the presidential election. And that really is, it's a problem with the media, but it's also a problem of, you know, just
I feel that
political discourse. I mean, you were working in Salon, and it's a problem of how we think about political discourse, right? Again, I've mentioned, right, us not really having like functional political parties. Right, in the UK, after the general election, I guess I should say like England and Scotland now because Brexit, but after the general election, you know, the leader of the Labour Party resigned because he had lost, and then the party has an election for who the new leader is. And like the closest thing we have to that right now is this fight over who's going to be the chair of the Democratic National Committee, which, you know, Keith Ellison wants to be, which I just also think that like, on a like even on a purely identity politics level, the idea of putting a black Muslim in charge of the Democratic Party in response to Trump is beautiful. I love it. Also, Keith Ellison is, you know, actually quite
a rad dude,
smart, and yeah, and once as an attorney was a defense attorney for a punk who had beaten up a Nazi punk. So Keith Ellison is down, and we love him. But like, aside from that, I also, you know, don't know if the Democratic Party brand is actually too damaged. Because there are a lot of people who just straight won't vote for Democrats because they feel like they've been screwed by Democrats. I don't really understand how they don't feel they've been screwed by Republicans, but that's another story. But whether or not that is a damaged brand, the question of electoral politics is going to be one, and especially on state and local levels, is going to be really important because that's going to be the line of defense to Trump, right? When you think about prison policy, for instance, right? That like most people who are incarcerated at the state and local level. They're not in federal prisons. So anything that Obama did or didn't do on that level was really, aside from immigration detention, sort of beside the point. And so that's a fight we need to be having on state and local levels. There are gonna be fights about a million things. The minimum wage fight has been being very successfully waged at state and local levels. And these are things that can be done. And as you said, you know, Shama Sawant, who is a, you know, a very vocal socialist, and they're trying to go after her right now, which I just, you know, sit back and it's like, what are you going to call her? She is a socialist. She's happy to tell you she's a socialist. She will try to convert you to socialism if you sit there with her for 20 minutes. And she's charming and lovely. And so what are you going to do? She is a socialist. Yes, we knew. We voted for her. She won a citywide election the first time because Seattle didn't have district city council seats the first time. They've since gone to them. But, you know, yeah, they know she's a socialist. What else are you going
to
say?
I mean, yeah, does it have to be either or? Either?
No,
either
everything right now has to be both and.
Yeah, all of the
everything
above, right?
Right now has to be both
whatever
and.
Makes sense in the context.
Yeah, and I you know, I live in a little, as I mentioned, a little city, 28,000 people, and one of the meetings that I went to in the last week and a half was, you know, my neighborhood. And partly it was our, you know, our city is 50% Latino. A good chunk of the population is undocumented. And our first priority was, how do we protect our neighbors? How do we keep people from getting deported? What do we have to do? What are the legal things we can do? What are the civil disobedience things we can do? You know, what can we do? And the other thing is, you know, we're talking about who's going to run for city council next time. And, you know, we're our mayor was, this is kind of a total tangent, but our mayor happens to be on a third party ticket, largely because she lost the Democratic primary and also got onto the Independence Party line. And so that has been an interesting experience, right? That like, oh, well, if we could do that, then we could do it again. And, you know, there are other places like Philadelphia where you used to live and I used to live that the city charter actually holds space on the city council for a non-majority party so that it can't be a one-party city council. Nothing says that the non-majority party has to be Democrats. In fact, I've been
Republicans.
Republicans, excuse me, yes. Right, so I've been nudging people at the Working Families Party. It's like, hey, you know, this is a thing. And they took advantage of it in Bridgeport, Connecticut.
They could just take those two seats.
Exactly.
It's Philadelphia.
I mean, right, exactly. The Republicans on the city council are basically still Democrats anyway. Yeah. Right, and so, you know, there are all sorts of questions about electoral strategy. But the real thing, I think, is that, like, we need a platform. Because we saw this right now, like, Tulsi Gabbard, who is, like, a high-profile Bernie Sanders endorser, is now having meetings with Trump. And this is the danger of running your politics around personalities,
and people
right?
are pointing out that she was a mixed political bag from the beginning.
Yeah, right? Well, exactly. Yeah. That's the thing. And you looked at her and you were like, okay, I mean, she really loves the Hindu nationalists. When your, you know, sort of political movement is based around like, well, who endorsed this particular guy? There were a lot of reasons why people did that.
Yeah.
Some of the people who endorsed him were genuinely, you know, left politicians like Keith Ellison. Others were Colin Peterson and Tulsi Gabbard. And so if you actually put out a platform and say like, okay, you are part of this movement if you support $15 an hour and universal health care and free college and, you know, undoing the mass incarceration state and whatever other things you want to put into a platform, then you actually, whatever, you know, whatever party line, I'm stealing this from Ireland, by the way, they did this in their last election, had a Right to Change platform, and people, Ireland has a lot of independent members of the parliament, many of whom are independent leftists who are not part of any of the smaller parties. So Sinn Féin was the biggest party that signed on to it, and then some of the smaller, there's a couple of little socialist formations, and then there's a bunch of independents, and all together they all signed on to this platform. And so and part of signing onto this platform, because of course it's a parliamentary system, was that if enough of them actually had a majority, they would form a government. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you don't have to have a parliamentary system to think that that kind of thing is useful, that like a lot of these left groups actually broadly agree on a lot of these things. And this could be a strategy to say like, okay, well, in this city council race, I'm running as a, you know, Working Families Party candidate. I'm running as a Green Party candidate. I'm running as a Socialist Alternative candidate. But these are broadly things that we agree on. And in some places you could run in a primary and you could, you know, primary some, you know, Democratic elected official in a Democratic controlled city, run a Democratic primary, but also say, I sign on to this platform. So anyway, these are just things that, I'm a journalist though. What the hell are people asking me about strategy for?
Obviously the social movements you chronicle in your book are not all 100% successes.
No.
You write
we
about
were just talking about Scott Walker, weren't we?
Exactly. You write about Wisconsin, where Scott Walker not only pushed through major anti-union legislation, but survived a recall campaign. And just a few weeks ago, Trump won the state.
Yeah.
A lot of young
Democrats
people
not
year,
going to that state.
Yeah. Experienced this major first political defeat of their lives, pouring all this energy into the Bernie campaign and then losing. Yep. Now Trump. But you show how movements can win in ways that are not always appreciated in the moment. I think Occupy is a great example of that. When the tents folded up in late 2011, a lot of one-time supporters were really down on Occupy at the time. I remember it very clearly. People were really hating hard on Occupy for lacking pragmatism and organization and a vision.
Yeah.
But Occupy really ultimately ended
really
up transforming.
Need to lack pragmatism right now. Anyway.
Right? It ended up having quite an impact that even they didn't see at the time.
No, and you know, I was talking about Occupy Sandy. I was talking earlier today in my friend Eric Loomis's class about strike debt and the Occupy Homes movement and these things that spun out of Occupy that really, you know, that took some of the lessons of Zuccotti Park and really managed to use them in concrete ways, both in terms of like mutual aid things like the home defense and Occupy Sandy and sort of more strategic things like, you know, debt strikes were something that people were talking about and tossing around a lot. And even the connections between the movement for Black Lives and Occupy is kind of, I mean, this is why I wanted to write this book the way I did, right? It was to put these things in context with each other and say, like, this isn't a book about Occupy Wall Street. This is a book about this particular period. And these are these attempts to do something that have certain things in common and that are all responses to broadly the same set of, like, I mean, the same crises, right? We should call it what it is. And so, yeah, I don't think it was also just kind of an interesting thing that we're like, everybody was sort of writing the same critique of Occupy. And I was like, listen, like, nobody has that critique more strongly than the people who lived through it. Because they were the ones in the 5-hour general assemblies getting shouted at by randos. people kept writing these pieces about, like, how consensus process is terrible. Like, I don't know anybody who went through Occupy who still wants to do 100% consensus process, because that was awful.
Yeah, I block 100% consensus.
Exactly. It was terrible. But people are really learning things in these spaces and learning them, again, in a way that turned, in many cases, to much more practical things. And so when you look at, like, the movement for Black Lives, there are organizations that have structures that have managed, like, to pull together really impressive collaborative projects, like the Vision for Black Lives statement, or platform, really, speaking of my talking about platforms. That would be a good one to co-sign. That is this really just massive, impressive policy document that is the work of something like 30 to 50 different organizations collaborating over the course of like a year. And so, you know, we are seeing the things that were criticized about Occupy actually, like, people did in fact learn from that.
And I mean, Occupy transformed the discussion in the United States for the long haul around wealth
and
equality, right?
And you know, in a way that, again, that I think, like, mainstream Democratic Party politicians didn't and don't fully understand, that, you know, it was, you know, Bernie Sanders was like the guy who was hanging around, who still talked about this stuff back when people came back around and started talking about it again. And my partner likes to say, you go to war with the democratic socialist you have, not the democratic socialist you wish you had. But it's true in England as well as here. But, you know, you had this. And, like, I remember, and I didn't put this in the book, and I thought of it later. I was like, why didn't I put this in the book? Remember in 2010 when, like, the debt ceiling battles were happening in Congress and everything was a nightmare, just like it's about to be again? And Bernie Sanders got up and gave this, like, 8-hour-long speech. And, like, I was at work, and I remember just, like, having it open in a corner, and then somebody made a single-serving website that was just, like, isBernieSandersStillTalking.com. And it was great. But it was this thing that, like, you know, when everything seemed awful, everything is horrifying as have been answering every how are you in the last 2 weeks.
I say fine, fascism notwithstanding.
Also a good one.
Major caveat.
But that kind of the connections back around there, right, are super interesting. Aside from talking about inequality, Occupy really talked about capitalism, right? We're talking about a system that is created by humans, and that 2008 showed us it can in fact die. And it might die whether we like it or not, in fact, before we're prepared to deal with it, which is what almost happened in 2008. I don't feel the need to rehabilitate Occupy or anything right now, but I'm just like looking at the world and going, we have to scale up so many of these things right now, but, like, we needed to anyway, and so I'm hoping that at least we can be a little bit clearer about the fact that we really did need to scale these things up anyway.
So speaking of some of the movements we've gone over, Occupy, the Movement for Black Lives, Fight for 15,
which is having a big strike next week. I hope everybody will be on the picket lines.
On the internet left right now.
Oh, God.
There's a very tired...
Stay off Twitter.
Very tired...
Don't tweet.
Old debate about class versus race. I think your book offers some really good reminders that on the ground...
Beat everybody over the head with it.
Amongst organizers and in social movements, Intersectionality is sort of the norm, and the inseparability of race, class, gender, sexuality are just sort of, their inseparability is just sort of taken
for granted. The lived reality of people who are in struggle, right? And sort of fighting about which Marxist theorist you like better on Twitter is just, to me, like, so beside the point. Angela Davis. Anyway, people have been saying this forever. It's not like it's new. When I look at the Vision for Black Lives platform is such an excellent example of this, right? Where you look at the programs that people are proposing, and they're universal healthcare and universal public education, and they are this. I'm editing a piece right now for Dissent by Jenae Bonsu from BYP 100 about reparations, and she's talking about reparations in the context of labor and saying, like, you know, prison labor, people who were arrested during the drug war, who, you know, now marijuana is being legalized and a bunch of rich white people are profiting off of it, while there are a whole bunch of people whose lives were ruined by selling marijuana, which now these people are making a ton of money off doing legitimately, right? So how can we think about those things in a reparations format? And it's funny because I'm actually getting pushback from some of the editors that was like, but some of these things she's talking about would not just be for black people. And like, this would be universal, but how is that reparations? And I'm like, you know, if you actually read the piece and think about how these things fit together, it's the problem is that people have a really narrow conception of like what, what the lived reality of these things really is.
And the attacks are interconnected as well. Like, you're right about the Walker's move against public sector unions in Wisconsin, which was very much an attack on, an attack on workers in general, but on black women in particular.
Right, exactly. When you think about who is in the public sector, who is in particularly the care work parts of the public sector, because of course Walker's bill carved out the police and firefighters unions. It was an attack on women workers in particular, and it was an attack on women of color workers in particular. And that really, you know, I remember talking to some wonderful nurses and school teachers from Wisconsin who really made this point very clearly, that this was the divide and conquer strategy. And, you know, at the same time he was doing this, he was trying to like placate the sort of more traditional private sector unions by saying he didn't want a right to work bill. Well, guess what? He passed a right to work bill. It was explicitly.
And the Thompson firefighters, you left them out at first, right?
The right to work, statewide right to work is statewide right to work.
Yeah, but initially.
Exactly. So the Thompson firefighters were left out. So the first people targeted are the ones who have the least power to fight back, or who are perceived as having the least power to fight back. Certainly, Wisconsin, they tried to fight back. The Walmart chapter is my favorite to talk about this, because Sam Walton very particularly built his business around women workers and around women workers who had not worked for wages before in their lives. And so this was a way to be able to undervalue their skills, was these were not things that were considered skills, right? Knowing how to build a table was a skill. Knowing how to, you know, miscellaneous other things, like, you know, were considered skills. But being nice to a customer when they're screaming in your face is not considered a skill that women needed to get a wage premium for. It was just what women were good at. We're good at putting up with people's bullshit, I guess. And this is, right, Walmart now has shaped the entire working class of this country. Whoever you are, whatever you look like, Walmart has set the wages for the entire service industry. And that was done by tackling, you know, by building their entire system around the expectations around women. So yeah. I could go on about this forever, but.
Yeah, I mean, it's such an important point, though, because every bad thing in our society, you start looking at the interconnectedness of things like racism and broader systems of exploitation, the caricature demonization of welfare queens allowed for the decimation of welfare for poor people of all races. Of
black welfare, and the majority of the people who were on welfare were white women.
Yeah, and the demonization of black criminals allowed for mass incarceration, which no doubt has disproportionately harmed black people, but has incarcerated enormous numbers of poor white people.
Right. Poll taxes and literacy requirements disenfranchised hundreds of thousands of poor white people. I mean, these things are leaky, right?
Yeah. And fundamentally fighting racism, white supremacy, like that's a key obstacle to even basic social democracy in the United States.
And it's clearly an issue we have to tackle because if people are voting for Donald Trump, then, you know, and they're motivated by, to whatever degree they're motivated by, again, this is, you know, the frustrating question of like, is it economic anxiety or is it racism? And I'm like, well, racism has always been inflamed in times of economic anxiety. Hi, look at Nazi Germany, not to, you know, get all Godwin on y'all, but like, seriously, but right, like we, this is invoked to give, to deflect the blame from the wealthy onto somebody else. And it is the weakest people in society who the blame is deflected onto. So whether that is saying that public sector workers are greedy and they're taking all your tax money and they don't need to get wage increases for the next 5 years or something, so we're going to take away their union rights, or whether that's saying that we need to deport 3 million Mexicans back to Mexico because something, you're taking your jobs. Either way, it's bullshit and it's deflecting from the people who are actually causing these problems.
Finally, before I open it up to questions from the audience, people are just a mix of really angry and upset right now. Your book's really optimistic in a lot of ways. Is there... give a reason for hope and whatnot to people.
Being angry is the right response. We should be. We should be angry. We should have been angry anyway, but we should be really angry now. Yeah, I mean, the thing that has given me so much hope over the last couple of weeks is those high school student walkouts. You know? These are the kids who couldn't vote, and everybody says, oh, everybody's apathetic, and that's why they didn't vote. These kids have opinions about this stuff, and they are ready to like not only express those opinions, but like take some risks to express those opinions, right? You get in trouble if you walk out of class. That's not a thing that your teachers mostly think is a great idea that you should do. And so, you know, I've got to be at least as brave as the kids who walked out of class in Phoenix and Omaha, I think. And I think most of us can do that.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to The Dig, produced by Alex Lewis, Jeffrey Brodsky, and Liza Yeager. Music by Brodsky. Follow us on Twitter at The Dig Radio, and join us next time for a discussion on the future of the immigrant rights movement under Trump. Things might look pretty bad, but we're happy that you're listening and fighting to make them better.